You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. And this is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner, volume 202, entitled Universal Spirituality and Human Physicality, Bridging the Divide, translated by Matthew Barton. This is lecture 2 of 16. Given in Dornach on the 27th of November, 1920. Yesterday, from a particular angle, we took another look at our connection as human beings with both the past and the future, basing this on what manifests in our external human form and its threefold organization, as we have often described this. The head organism, which relates back to the past, the limb organism relating forward into the future, and then also the rhythmic organism of lungs and heart, which really belongs to the present. In order to be able to round off this whole complex of facts tomorrow, let us now first consider the other aspect of our human nature, the more inward qualities of soul life. Just as we can distinguish three parts of the human body, the head, the activity based on the rhythmic system, and the limb organism, so we can discern three aspects of inner life as well. These are thinking or picturing, feeling, and will. A threefold division exists in the psyche, as it does in the physical body. Here again, in this life of soul, we can inquire into our whole position vis-à-vis the cosmos. Let us first consider thinking or picturing. This life of thinking and thoughts is without doubt the most defined and delineated activity within us. On the one hand, it leads us out into the cosmos, in a sense, and on the other, it also leads us into our inner experience. In our life of thinking, we acquaint ourselves with phenomena throughout the cosmos. We absorb all that must be regarded as the originating source from which our head emerges and develops, as we saw yesterday. On the other hand, however, we bring our thoughts and ideas back into ourselves and retain them within us as memories, developing our inner life in accordance with these thoughts. This life of thinking and thoughts is primarily connected with our head. The head is its organ. This can already tell us that the destiny of our thinking is, in a sense, connected with that of the head. Relating back to the past as it does, and given that we lead the germinal, soul-spiritual form of our head development into physical existence at birth, we can see that we likewise bring our thinking with us from pre-birth existence. But we can also discover other objective reasons for regarding our life of thinking in this way. As stated, it is the most clearly defined and fully rounded aspect of our inner life. And it contains elements that basically have nothing at all to do with our individual nature here in the physical world. If you consider the mathematical truths, or perhaps also the truth of logic, that we can discover within us, it is clear that we cannot verify such truths by empirical observation. Instead, we have to elaborate mathematical or geometrical truth from within. In us lies the truth of the theorem of Pythagoras, or of the fact that the three angles of a triangle add up to 180 degrees. We can illustrate such truths for ourselves by drawing corresponding figures, yet their proof is not demonstrated on the blackboard. Rather, through inner contemplation, we elaborate a mathematical strand in our thinking. There are many other strands that interweave themselves with our thinking, and we only know about such mathematical truths due to the fact that we are human beings. Even if thousands or millions of people were to tell us that the theorem of Pythagoras is untrue, as an individual, we could discover its truth through our own inner processes. What causes this? It is due simply to the fact that we do not first develop our life of thinking in the physical realm, as we do our life of feeling and will, but that we already bring it with us into physical existence at birth. This is something we can certainly discern in the nature of the human being if we observe him carefully. And for the spiritual researcher, it comes to expression in the following way. Let us assume that a person progresses to what has been called imaginative thinking. This imaginative life of the psyche involves us dwelling in inner pictures that are, however, not mediated to us by our senses. In ordinary external life, we perceive the objects around us by means of our sense organs. These convey images to us through eyes and ears, and our thinking gathers these images together and encompasses them. Imaginative thinking is different. Here, if we have undergone the right preparation, we have images that arise without outer perception. These arise within us, you can say. But we do not cease thinking when we raise ourselves to imaginative soul life in the right way. We now think in inner images, in the same way that we normally think about the images conveyed to us by our perception of outer objects. And yet, the present moment is not the first thing we experience when we develop our capacity for imaginative thinking, when we continue to think and infuse our whole soul with thinking, but at the same time experience images rising within us. The first thing, rather, is that images of our pre-birth or preconception life arise before us. Our present life only surfaces in images at a later stage, after long practice, and then does not do so with anything like the same clarity and definition as our pre-birth or preconception life. This fact demonstrates unequivocally that in turning away from a perception of outer objects, and thus coming to live and think in images, this thinking can initially only present us with images from the past. In the pictures surfacing in us in this way, we have a cosmic reality from our life before birth. This, along with various other things, tells us that our life of thinking is what we first bring with us from our life prior to birth. If we observe ourselves with a sufficiently open mind, we find that our feeling life only gradually develops in physical existence. We are unable to inform our feeling with anything as clearly defined as mathematics, as thoughts. All our feelings have to be developed from childhood on, and only from then on in the life commencing with birth. The more we experience from birth onward, the richer our life of feeling will be. Someone who has experienced great suffering and grave strokes of destiny will have a different feeling life from another who sails easily through life and just skates over the surface of experience. The blows of destiny we encounter prepare and deepen our life of feeling. A mathematical concept penetrates our thinking very suddenly, whereas a feeling is something we cannot elaborate so fast. A feeling forms gradually and is something that grows with us, participating in the whole process of our growth within physical life. Likewise, our life of will does not connect us with the cosmos very much to begin with. It pulses up out of us from unknown depths of our soul. In our actions, though, we do bear will life into the cosmos. But consider the difference between the connection we have to the cosmos in thinking and the different kind of connection to it in our will. Our thinking connects us with the cosmos when, say, we go out on a bright starry night, and in a sense have the cosmos before us as picture and encompass it in our thoughts. We can also feel it. How small, by contrast, are the few deeds we release from the element of our will and unite with the cosmos. This tells us that the will element is rooted in us in a quite different way from the element of thinking. Just compare the will element with the element of thinking and that of feeling. Once we have awoken sufficiently to the element of thinking, it connects us immediately with the whole cosmos. The feeling, the element of feeling, lives its way into the cosmos more gradually, doing so as slowly or as quickly as is governed by our destiny and unfolding life between birth and death. Yes, albeit less intensively and extensively than thinking, it does still connect us with the cosmos. To be connected with the cosmos in thinking is something really universally human. Imagine three people who go out into the bright starry night, standing at a particular place together. All three will have the same picture of the cosmos, will all see the same thing, and when they have learned to encompass this picture in thoughts, all three will also be able to have the same immediate view of it in their minds. Feeling is different. Let us imagine someone whose life passes in a fairly unthinking and superficial way, who has only rarely looked up at night to the starry sky. Let us compare what such a person feels when he goes out one night and sees the star-strewn heavens with a different quality of feeling in someone who, one evening, goes for a long walk with someone he hardly knew until then. Imagine that during this walk they come to speak of profound matters of life and destiny, that their discussion lasts many hours, all night until the stars begin to fade. Let us imagine that the friends become close at a moment when the starry heavens are shining with wonderful brilliance, and that after many years, after this friendship has passed through all kinds of stages and developments, this person again looks up to the star-strewn sky. Imagine the feelings that may rise up in him then, as a lingering resonance from his experience of the friendship. In this way, feelings do indeed find their way out into the cosmos. Yet the extent to which they do so is governed by the kind of life a person has led since birth. Our thoughts go out into the cosmos in thinking simply because we are born as human beings and have brought soul and spirit with us into physical existence at birth. Our inner life of soul goes out into the cosmos through feeling, but the extent to which it does so is governed by what has occurred in this physical life itself. If you try to think through to the end what I've been saying here, you will find that our life of thinking is introduced into physical existence at birth, that our feeling life is something we develop between birth and death, but that very few will impulses in our actions emanate from us into the cosmos. How little of what flows from our will impulses is actually incorporated into the cosmos. Here, therefore, we find something that appears primitive compared to our feelings, and still more so by contrast to our thinking faculties. The spiritual researcher can discover the reasons for this when he raises himself to intuition, where he reaches the level of these will impulses. The moment he ascends through his inner development to intuition, where all else in his soul life is extinguished, he finds something very remarkable before him, something other than his current life of actions and deeds. As the first experience at the level of intuition, he discovers not his actions themselves, but everything implicit in his actions in the form of destiny, germinal destiny for the future. What appears here to the faculty of intuition as first impression is informed by the future. Everything that we can become due to our having performed a sum of actions, a sum we cannot see ourselves, but whose germinal forms appear before our soul. This shows us that our life of will is what we carry with us through death as a pointer toward the future. Schematically, therefore, we can say that in the physical domain of the body, we have our head system, our rhythmic system of lungs and heart, and our limb system. Our head shows us what we bring with us from the past. Our rhythmic system points us to the present, our current life between birth and death. Our limb system points toward the future, and from it our head will again develop in a subsequent life. In the realm of the psyche, we have the faculty of thinking, pointing us back to the past, our feeling life pointing us to the present, and our will life pointing us toward the future. Yesterday we saw that the human head is connected with the periphery, with the whole cosmos, whereas our limb system is connected with the earth. The same is true of soul faculties. Our thinking is connected with the cosmos, our will with the earth, and our rhythmic life, the element of feeling that mediates between them, balances between the two, between the heavenly and the earthly. We have also suggested that in ancient times of primeval instinctive wisdom, what emanates from the earth and works into the human limbs, only somewhat modified by the cosmos and its effect, was referred to as vigor, that what comes to expression in us as the head organism, by nature cosmic, yet attenuated by the earthly, has been called beauty since ancient times, and that the balancing element between both of these, living in our rhythmic system, was named wisdom. These same terms were used also in reference to soul faculties. Thinking in ancient mystery wisdom was conceived as being permeated by the principle of beauty. Feeling was regarded as being imbued with wisdom, and will life was thought to be penetrated by vigor. Now we can turn to the human being's spiritual nature in the same way that we considered the two realms of physical body and soul. Here too we find a threefold spirit nature in us, though in this case we must speak of three, in quotes, states. We can first distinguish here between what the spirit reveals to us in, if you like, its full illumination, when we are fully awake, contrasted with the state of dreaming, halfway between waking and sleep, and then also with the state of deep unconscious sleep, when the spirit is quite unaware of earthly life. Here we have the threefold spirit in waking, dreaming, and sleeping. Consider waking life. To unprejudiced observation, it is perfectly clear that this waking life represents our most mature and developed state, and is what we bring with us into physical existence at birth. While this state does not appear immediately, it is nevertheless the most perfect condition, the most mature, and is given us by virtue of us being born as human beings. We can therefore say that waking life points us to the past. Dream life, on the other hand, while it may seem strange initially to say that dream life points to the present, and yet this is so. At a certain stage of life, you can see very clearly how dream life relates to the present. The young child, the infant, is still wrapped in dream and has not yet developed a fully waking life. Waking life only begins for the child when the past starts to filter into him. But the present exists in dream life. Our dream life increasingly incorporates a waking state because our pre-birth nature, our past, finds its way into the present. The present, as such, only teaches us to dream. And sleep is the aspect of us that does not as yet belong to the present, and is related to our life of will, the least perfect part of us, which must still be perfected. It is the part within us that prefigures the future, that points toward the future. Thus our spirit belongs to all three, to past, present, and future, to the past in waking life, to the present in dream life, and to the future in deep sleep. So we can connect these three conditions, these three different levels of the human being, with the past, present, and future of the cosmos, We did this yesterday already in relation to the physical body. We saw that the whole of our head development is connected with former conditions through which our Earth passed during Saturn, Sun, and Moon evolution. Our limb system shows us that something is developing in us that cannot yet come to full completion on the Earth. You were amused when I spoke of Venus evolution, during which the human being will come to be configured in a way quite different from our current condition on the Earth. I said that on Venus, the human being will lose his head midway through the course of his life, and that this will be replaced by another that grows from his limb organism. As I suggested, this might be very welcome for some people nowadays, but is sadly not yet possible. Today we have to make do with our head as it is, for although our limb organism has the tendency to become head, it can only actually do so after life on Earth, after passing between death and a new birth and a new life. But this limb organism points us toward what we will physically become as a result of Jupiter, Venus, and Vulcan evolution. And so our head points us back to Saturn, Sun, and Moon. Our limb organism points us forward into the future, toward Jupiter, Venus, and Vulcan, while our rhythmic system points us to our present condition during Earth evolution. However, our life of thinking does not point us as far back into the past as the head. In a sense, the head had to exist already in the cosmos before it could begin to think. Thus, our thinking points back only as far as Sun and Moon. Will life points us forward to a future on Jupiter and Venus, and our life of feeling belongs once again to the present. Now, we come to the spirit with waking and sleeping life. Waking life takes us back only as far as Moon evolution, the imaginative thinking faculty of Moon. During Sun evolution, there was no life of thinking as such. The condition of sleep points us as far as Jupiter evolution. Following this period, what nowadays moves within sleep will assume outward forms, whereas only after Venus evolution will our condition of will likewise assume outward forms. And, as already stated, the limbs will assume outward forms during the three subsequent conditions of our Earth's evolution. Thus we can, as follows, assign the human being's body, soul, and spirit to the cosmos. I'll try reading this. It's a little chart, but I'll read it from left to right going down. So at head, we have Saturn, Sun, Moon. Next to that is thinking, Sun, Moon. Next to that, waking, life, Moon. Then after that is sleep, Jupiter. Will, life, Jupiter and Venus. Limb system, Jupiter, Venus, and Vulcan. Sorry for that. Again, back to Steiner. Once again, ancient wisdom regarded waking life, dream life, and sleep in terms, respectively, of beauty, wisdom, and vigor. From sleep we draw strength and vigor for life. The wise thinking of very ancient times was founded on this kind of living knowledge. But we can now, in turn, apply to human life the insights into the threefold human being which we develop in spiritual science. For example, we might start with the spirit and ask ourselves what effect it has on outward life if we seek to survey this life with clear thoughts and ideas. We can carry this life of thinking in the head into the external world. In an alert, waking state, we can penetrate our outer life with thought. This particular way of being active in the external world, by penetrating it with our life of thinking, belongs to the realm of the mind and spiritual life. If we proceed from here to consider our inner life of feeling, seeing this in terms of dream life as far as the spirit is concerned, we can ask how this dream life is configured. You need only study life itself and you will sense how dream holds sway in human beings. It is worth paying careful attention to what happens in you when you form friendships, when you develop feelings of love for another person. In this domain, you will discover, I'm sure you'll agree, that you cannot be awake in the same way as when you think through the theorem of Pythagoras. If you attend carefully to your own experiences, you will inevitably find that your inner state, when you form friendships or when you have an inclination to do something or other for someone, really has an affinity with dream life. In feelings that hold sway between people in outer life, you find the quality of dream. This is also the kind of life we elaborate in the life of rites, where one person stands in a general type of relationship to another. We find our own distinctive relationships with people when we love one person and hate another, or form a friendship with one person but cannot stand another one, and so forth. These are our different specific relationships. But human life worldwide is only made possible by virtue of all human beings having the right to enter into certain kinds of relationship, which we can describe as statutory and legal ones. These too are not governed by the same wakeful alertness with which we penetrate daily life, but by dream life. Rites life arises where we incorporate into the external world the second aspect of the spirit, this dream life. And what happens when we incorporate the life of sleep? Take an unprejudiced look at life. You feel hungry, say, or you take pleasure in a gold ring with precious stones, or perhaps you feel the urge to read a volume of lyric poetry. In other words, you have a need of some kind which is satisfied by others. But let me ask you this. Are you able to survey the whole scope of such things in the same way that you can survey your friendships or legal rights and relationships? No one can do this. An individual can lead a dream life in relation to legal relationships, but economic relationships cannot be surveyed in this way. For here we are compelled to associate with others. And then what one person does not know can be known by another. The individual's awareness is subsumed in the association, vanishes there. Here something exists that unfolds entirely in the unconscious, and can only do so because one individual is quite incapable of surveying the whole thing, but instead allows his consciousness to be subsumed in that of the association. And here we have economic life. The life of the spirit is governed by social wakefulness, rites life by social dreaming, and really by nightmare, also a kind of dream in modern parliamentary processes. Economic life is imbued with social sleep, and where human soul life fades and vanishes into the unconscious, love must spread through associative life. Love is a will element, and fraternity has to pervade economic life. Freedom is the distinctive quality of waking life, whereas fraternity is that of sleep life. And between these two is the realm in which all are equal, which they develop together as equals, and is determined only by the relationship between people into which individual waking life fades. I would therefore put it like this: what each person bears within him flows into social interaction. And we cannot really understand the life of society except by seeing it in terms of what flows into it from every single individual. Number one, life of spirit, social waking. Number two, life of rights, social dreaming. Number three, life of economics, social sleep. We have now summarized a set of human circumstances from a particular perspective, and tomorrow we will elaborate further on this. But it is worth pausing here to reflect on how such things come toward us nowadays. A modern person can start by reading my book titled Theosophy. Your previous education may lead you to think this somewhat paradoxical, Initially, you may not give much credence to what is presented there, but then you can go further and read the other books and discover that what is found in Theosophy is taken further and deepened. And then you will come to see that these things all mutually sustain each other, and that they are all well-founded. Or you can start with the book titled Toward Social Renewal. And to begin with, you may find it hard to see why the social order should be membered in a threefold way. But by compiling everything we have examined from all sorts of different angles, we repeatedly clarify why society does indeed need to be subject to threefold organization. Consider for a moment how we derive social threefolding from the human being himself, from his conditions of soul and spirit, a threefold state of soul and spirit. Once again, one thing supports and sustains the other. And of course we could complement what has been said here with many other aspects, which will likewise justify a threefold approach to the social organism. However, if you compare what I have said now with the conduct of our contemporaries, you will find something far more superficial at work. How do people generally relate to what comes toward them in the form of anthroposophic spiritual science? I am not quite clear if I have got this right. Dr. Buss can correct me if I'm wrong, but I gather that at a lecture which he gave recently to theologians in Basel, he inquired of the man who has attacked me most fiercely whether he had ever actually attended any of my lectures. Apparently the person concerned said that he might have attended one or possibly two. This is a typical example. People only want to hear one lecture or read just a few pages of a book. But this is not adequate for judging spiritual science and everything connected with it, including its social consequences. You see, the science of the spirit asks us to develop a relationship with everything that is different from this kind of superficial glance. Such people drill the students entrusted to them without a science of the spirit, and drill themselves likewise, and then they come along and take a quick glance at spiritual science. But this won't work. The only fruitful approach would be for a science of the spirit really to penetrate our whole education system, and for anthroposophically permeated thought to replace what has become so devoid of spirit during recent centuries. It is important for us at least to know what is needed. No headway can be made in spiritual science simply by dragging someone along to a single lecture for opportunistic reasons. Nothing will come of it, mostly, except that the person in question will take fright. Instead, the science of the spirit must find its way into our whole education system, our whole contemporary life. Naturally, this is a stumbling block for spiritual science. But on the other hand, it shows us how necessary an obligation it is for us to commit ourselves fully, with all our capacities, to this science of the spirit, once we ourselves have grasped its living essence. Unfortunately, though, putting our whole self at the service of this work is not something that has always been cultivated in the Anthroposophical Society. That people have sometimes felt ashamed of acknowledging they are anthroposophists tends to lodge itself in one's memory. Lectures are organized without mention of the word theosophy or anthroposophy. The lecture in question is supposed to be anthroposophical, but cannot be openly declared to be so. And a veil is drawn over such terms as the anthroposophic movement or theosophy and so forth. We have experienced the same thing with eurythmy, when people wanted to introduce it into schools without saying where it comes from. Things are supposed to, quote, filter through, close quote, as people like to put it. Letting things slip in like this, in other words, shying away from standing behind something fully, will not help us make headway. Instead, everywhere we encounter things rooted in the modern outlook, which in fact are culturally untenable. Not long ago, Frau Baumann, a Waldorf Eurythmy teacher, wrote a very good article for a Swiss woman's journal about the educational potential of eurythmy. The article was published, but the editors deleted all mention of anthroposophy or even of my name. These things show that while people can make use of things of cultural value, they wish to do so only in the deceitful way of modern times, sundering things of value from their originating powers, which must sustain them if they are to serve contemporary needs. Shying away from full commitment, the Anthroposophical Society, with its policy of, quote, letting things find their way in, close quote, through the back door, has to take a good deal of responsibility for this. Whoever approaches this source and resource of anthroposophy and sees how things mutually sustain and enhance one another with mathematical clarity ought to find in this fact the courage and strength to stand up for anthroposophy in the world. We really do humanity no service at all by drawing back from full espousal of what we believe in, which is something we could easily learn from our opponents. They are fully committed to their opposition. We can repeatedly see how every sharp word we are necessarily obliged to utter elicits a disparaging reaction. For instance, very recently I was severely taken to task for calling Count Kaiserling what he is, for saying he had lied. Someone who says that my work is based on Haeckel need only read my commentaries on Goethe's scientific writings to discover the starting point of my work. It will soon be clear whom I have drawn on in my writings. Kaiserling is lying when he says that Haeckel was my inspiration, simply because I once wrote a pamphlet on him. Dullards like Kaiserling do not trace the closer contexts. Yet such empty-headed people draw large audiences because they do not tax people's thinking. It really is high time for people to recognize that when circumstances require it, though only then, we are sometimes obliged to utter harsh words, and that we really do not do so with any sense of enjoyment. Nor should anyone imagine that this betrays a lack of charity or kindness. Should we love those who lie and so obscure the truth? This is the perspective from which to view such things. Those who think we resort to harsh polemic should ask, what has drawn this fire, should take a look at those who attack us. When necessary, we stand up vigorously to our attackers, and there is real purpose in doing so. But nothing will be gained if we desert the few voices willing to stand up and defend us. The end of Lecture 2.